From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, big news coming out of the state capitol. Governor Snyder says right to work is on his agenda.
This is about the relationship between unions and their workers, or the workers in the workforce. And this is to give people the ability to choose and decide who they associate with.
We'll talk with a labor economist about what right to work would mean for Michigan.
What it will mean is very little in terms of improved economic growth, improved job growth.
Plus, we hear from the senior vice president of the Michigan Chamber of Commerce, supporter of right to work.
If it does pass, what it does do, it gives workers the right to demand more accountability from their unions.
Those stories and much, much more are ahead for you today on Stateside. But first, the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. We have a really, really packed show for you this Thursday. For fun, we'll travel to a pop-up beer garden in Detroit. Yes, it's still open, even in this chilly weather. And we're going to talk to the directors of the stunning new film opening this weekend, Burn, 1 year on the front lines of the battle to save Detroit. But first, to Lansing. Governor Snyder announced today, along with the majority leaders of the state, House, and Senate, that right-to-work bills will be introduced in the state legislature. The legislation is being called the Workplace Equity and Fairness Act. It would cover all workers in the state. So that means both public and private, with a big exception, except for police officers and firefighters. So essentially, this means union membership would now be voluntary. It lets workers at unionized companies opt out of paying membership dues. Protesters have filled the halls in the rotunda of the state capitol as lawmakers prepare to vote on the measures. Joining me now, Zoe Clark and Rick Pluta, the co-hosts of It's Just Politics here on Michigan Radio, to look at what's going on in Lansing. Zoe here in the studio, and Rick, you're at the ground right there in Lansing. Lots and lots of activity. What is the mood right now in Lansing?
Well, I'm standing in the rotunda of the capital city, and you can hear the people who are around me who are yelling. And what they're yelling is, let them in, because what's happened is the building managers and the state police have basically closed off access to the building. So where before, you know, there were lots and lots of people, now it really, you know, just in terms of the actual numbers, kind of resembles a typical session day. And so, legislative Democrats say that they've gone to court to get an order to have the Capitol reopened. The state police say that it's a safety issue, and so that's why they're limiting the access. But, you know, I spoke to a state police inspector earlier today who also said, we are not going to have a Wisconsin here.
Now, we have heard reports of tear gas being used.
Well, not tear gas, but pepper spray or something a lot like it was used to subdue some of the protesters who basically charged the state police troopers who were guarding the entrance to the state Senate. And, they used the things that police officers used to subdue them, including something a lot like pepper spray. I have not confirmed an exact number, but I've heard four people may have been charged with disorderly conduct, resisting arrest, something like that.
All right. So, Zoe, I want to turn to you. Sure. Put this all into context. Why now and what's behind all of this?
Well, that is the $64,000 question. For weeks, we have been hearing Governor Snyder say right to work, not on his agenda. Mm-hmm. Then late a couple evenings ago, Governor Snyder came out and said it is on the agenda, meaning well, someone's agenda. Obviously, what happened was it got brought onto his agenda now. And just this morning, as you mentioned, Cindy, the governor came out with Senate Majority Leader Randy Richardville and with the House Speaker Jace Bulger, both Republicans, and said, we are introducing this legislation. Here it is. It's now on everyone's agenda, at least the Republicans who are in charge agenda.
Yeah, kind of over the space of 48 hours, it went from not on my agenda to on the agenda to now it's on my agenda.
Is this not so much a matter of Democrat versus Republican, but Republican versus Republican?
No, it's largely Democrat versus Republican. Unions are a core part of the Democratic coalition. And so Democrats have said that they will do everything that they can legally do to try and stop this from happening. And already there's talk of, you know, what happens, you know, if and when, and it certainly seems to be a question of when at this point, you know, right to work becomes law. That they're talking about targeting vulnerable Republicans for recall. This will probably be immune to a referendum. We can talk about that later. But that doesn't mean that unions couldn't go to the ballot to try to initiate a law or even amend the state constitution to try and repeal right to work after it's been passed.
Right, but I do think, Cindy, that what you're doing, you're bringing up a really important question here, which is what we've seen and why there was this dynamic of sort of is he, meaning Governor Snyder, mm-hmm. will he, won't, is he going to say yes to right to work, or is he at least going to sort of show that this is what's going to happen? And it was an intra-party Republican, what is going to go on here? I mean, when you've got the majority in both chambers, in the executive branch, you're going to see some intra-party issues, some
friction.
Some friction, and so the GOP that's further to the right, Governor Snyder, who tends to be more center, who has not wanted to focus on these sort of controversial issues. Mm-hmm. This, you know, he's all about kind of that positive, relentless action, not wanting to be divisive. And so when I think you say, is this sort of, you know, Republicans versus Republicans, there was a lot of that. And I think what you're seeing here is the Republicans who tend to be farther to the right are getting their way. And it's not, let's remember, it's not just right to work during this lame duck session that we're seeing them get their way, that there are a couple other really controversial issues right now that Republicans, because they're in the majority, are able to push through. So what do you both think? Go ahead.
I mean, Zoe, exactly nailed it. That Republican versus Republican friction, as Zoe said, is now past tense. It was. That there was almost this kind of east-west divide where West Michigan Republicans were really gung-ho on getting right to work, especially after Proposal 2 was rejected by voters just a month ago. Whereas, Southeast Michigan and Southeast Michigan business people were a little more sanguine about it. They're like, we've learned to live with unions. We've learned to work with our unions. That it's not as big, it's not as big an issue for us as a lot of other things. And so now we seem to be, seeing some horse trading. Certainly one of the big issues is, some kind of mass transit system for Southeast Michigan, creating an authority to get that rolling. And now it's, Republicans versus Democrats. The governor, he tried to put this off. He didn't want it to happen. Unions actually thought that whatever other differences they might have, that at the very least when it came to right to work, they had a friend in a firewall in Rick Snyder. And, today, needless to say, they're sad and mad about that.
So what do you think, Zoe, what will Governor Snyder get in return for this?
Well, and I think that is what everyone's trying to understand right now, that what the governor often says, as we've liked to talk about, particularly mm-hmm. on Just Politics, is those words, not on my agenda. And yet what we're seeing with the governor, we can remember the helmet law repeal that he says, no, I don't want to have to deal with this. And yet when his fellow Republicans actually do, then put it on his desk, he signs it, or at least says he's about to, in terms of right to work. I think Rick probably has maybe some of the insider game about what's being traded right now. I think one really interesting thing to note, though, is that, not all of this, not just right to work, the emergency manager law, these aren't things that are happening in just sort of these rooms by themselves. These are all working together, these mechanics. And so lawmakers right now are talking and going, well, I'll vote for this bill if maybe you're going to be more willing to look at these bills about education reform. And I'm going to be more willing to say, okay, about personal property tax if maybe I will give you a vote to right to work. So in terms of lawmakers, what's going on right now is if you can sort of see these mechanics of people just sort of going, how is this relationship going to work? What am I going to get? What are you going to get? And how is it going to work? In terms of what Snyder is going to get, I would go to Rick and say, what is in this for the governor?
Well, for conservative Republicans for whom right to work is kind of the holy grail, that, you know, they're coming across and saying, if we can make this thing happen, or if we can make it happen more easily than we would otherwise, maybe we would be willing to vote for things that before we wouldn't be supportive, you know, supportive of. Southeast Michigan mass transit, for example, that authority is something that you know, just came up. But it really seems like in some respects, you know, it was Governor Snyder who was trying to cut the best deal he could once it became evident that right to work in the Republican-led House and the Republican-led Senate, that in the legislature, right to work had reached critical mass, and it was going forward, and something was coming his way.
Let me ask you this, so I start with you.
Yeah.
What price do you think that Governor Snyder might pay? There's a lot of unhappy people now in Michigan.
There are, but this is what is so smart about all of this, is that the price to pay is less to do it now, that the price would have even been bigger once there's a new legislative session, because let's remember, the next election, November 2014, the entire House, the Senate, the governor, the state attorney general, the secretary of state, everyone is up for re-election. Everyone is starting
to... Everyone who's not term limited out.
Thank you, exactly.
Right,
the seats that are open, the people who can run again, who most likely, obviously, will. You know, that is what now, if you can even believe it, I know it was just November last month, we just had an election, but these people are already looking ahead. And I think for a lot of them, they're going, let's get the dirty work done now, much like the pension tax that we saw a couple years ago. Let's get it done now so that we can have a little while to start doing some things to get voters to kind of, you know, be a little okay with it. And let's remember also in lame duck session, there's plenty of legislators who are voting right now who this is their last session. And so they're going to be more willing to vote for things that otherwise they wouldn't.
Right. We have a bunch of Republicans who are retiring. We have a bunch of Republicans who have been termed out. In the next session, there are going to be five fewer Republicans in the legislature,
exactly.
Which means that if you're dealing with an issue that has if it's going to pass, it's going to be by a tight margin, that complicates it. Right to work always presented a conundrum for Rick Snyder, and for that matter, you know, maybe some other, you know, moderate Republicans, that to actively oppose it would put him crossways with the conservative wing of his party that really dominates a Republican primary. And if he's too forceful in opposing it, then that's inviting a primary challenge from the right. But now that, you know, right to work seems to be a reality, that's going to complicate things for him, you know, post-primary season going into the general election, where the general public is not as embracing of right to work as the Republican right.
We'll have to leave it there for now. Zoe Clark and Rick Plute are the co-hosts of It's Just Politics here on Michigan Radio. Thanks for talking with us.
Thanks, Cindy.
Oh, my pleasure.
Still to come, we'll continue our look at what right-to-work legislation would mean for our state. Then we find out what life is really like for Detroit's firefighters. That's in 25 minutes here on Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Michigan State Police say they have used chemical spray on right-to-work protesters who tried to rush into the Senate chamber at the state capitol. Eight people were arrested for resisting and obstructing when they tried to rush past two troopers who were guarding the Senate door. The troopers used chemical spray after the people refused to obey orders to stop. An inspector at the state capitol says the capitol has been temporarily closed because of concerns for the safety of people and of the building. He estimated about 2,500 visitors were at the capitol, and the inspector says the building was not at capacity, but protesters were heavily concentrated in a few areas. We're looking at what right to work will mean to Michigan, its workers, its businesses. How will we feel its impact on our state and its economy? This past Monday, the Michigan Chamber of Commerce announced it was throwing its weight behind right to work. We turn now to Jim Holcomb with the Michigan Chamber of Commerce.
Thanks for having me.
Well, the 6,800-member Michigan Chamber of Commerce changed its position this week, correct? Going from no position to we support it. What was behind that decision?
Well, at first, I guess I would say it wasn't a change of position. As you just indicated, we had no position. We're a member-driven, policy-focused organization, and so we need to make sure that we're listening to our members and we have certain process that we go through. And one of those is a board meeting to adopt a formal policy. So we were waiting till our board actually met and adopted a policy in support of this Freedom to Work legislation.
And you had what percentage of your members supported Right to Work?
Our last count, when we did a survey, there was 85% supported this legislation.
And that clearly told you what you needed to do.
That, in addition to listening to our board of directors, we have a very strong, active volunteer leadership, and our board actually sets all the policy for the chamber, and they met in a special session and debated this and had a vigorous debate and came out strongly in support.
And what were the overwhelming and overriding reasons for supporting this?
There was two. First and foremost, it's a workers' freedom issue. This is about equality and fairness in the workplace. This is making sure that every employee has the right to choose for themselves whether joining a union is beneficial to them and their family or not. And also, we think there are many indicators that say this is good for Michigan's overall economy and good for all citizens as we continue to grow and prosper here in the state and reinvent Michigan.
What do you think, as this goes through and Right to Work becomes the law of the land in Michigan, what do you see that meaning for Michigan as far as a big picture?
Big picture, I think it's going to make Michigan more economically competitive. I think it's better for employees across the state, and I think both of those are good things because they work in tandem to make sure the state is stronger and we're attractive to future businesses and for people who want to grow our business here. As you know, unfortunately, Michigan was the only state in the last census to lose population, and we think this is not a silver bullet, but it's one of those factors that can have a dramatic impact in Michigan and help us grow our economy and make sure Michigan's a strong place for our families and our future generations.
Jim Holcomb, some critics will say that Right to Work has not helped economies in states where it's been the law. How do you respond to that?
I would say they're wrong. We commissioned through the Michigan Chamber Foundation the most extensive research document today, and we did this, you know, as we were leading up to this throughout this last 2 years as the debate was ongoing, and the numbers were clear. Growth in personal income, growth in gross state product, state job growth, net population migration coming in so you have more people living here in a state. And so the numbers are clear that it absolutely is one factor. It's not a silver bullet, and I don't think anyone is saying that it is, but it certainly is a strong correlation between freedom to work states and a strong, healthy, vibrant economy.
Jim, now that it appears that clearly one side has lost and one side has won, let's talk a bit about your sense of what it might mean in terms of relationship between management and union members once Michigan becomes Right to Work.
I think it actually strengthens it. What we've seen is many, many union rank and file support this legislation. This is about workers' rights, and I think too often we get caught up into that this is somehow anti-union. Unions still exist. They still have the right to collectively bargain. They still retain all the elements before this legislation passes, if it does pass. What it does do, it gives workers the right to demand more accountability from their unions, that if they are to be continuing in a union, their management in the union is going to have to be more responsive to them. So I think whenever you have a healthier debate within your workforce and your workers are strong and happy, that's always good for management-labor relations.
Jim Holcomb, Michigan Chamber of Commerce. Thank you so much for talking with us today on Stateside.
Thank you very much.
Jim Holcomb is with the Michigan Chamber of Commerce. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty, looking at what Right to Work will mean in Michigan and its impact on our state and its economy. We turn now to Dale Bellman. He's a labor relations professor at Michigan State University. So here's a great divide. What do you see ahead for our state now that one side has clearly lost and one side has clearly won? Here we have this divide. We have a side that seems to have clearly won and a side that has clearly lost. What do you think this divide will mean for Michigan?
I think on one level that what it will mean is very little in terms of improved economic growth, improved job growth. There's no evidence that in the past 30 years, right to work laws improve the overall economy of a state. That may have been true in the 50s and 60s when states such as Alabama and Mississippi could engage in, as it were, beggar thy neighbor policies in which they would attract industrial jobs from Michigan through right to work legislation. there's no statistical evidence that that's been effective in the last 30 years. So we can't expect to see faster job growth or that sort of change from right-to-work laws. What we will see is a decline in wages and benefits for working people in Michigan, because that seems to be part of the right-to-work passage. With the weakening of unions, wages decline and benefits fall, and the people of Michigan will be worse off for that.
And you feel that without beyond the shadow of a doubt, I can tell.
There's very strong statistical evidence of that. And when I talked about the effect on the overall economy, again, this is based on a number of statistical studies and good outlets. And what they seem to indicate, as I said, is that there probably was, and immediately after the passage of right-to-work legislation, gains to having a right-to-work law. But that hasn't been the case for 30 or more years.
You know, making Michigan a right-to-work state is such an enormous cultural shift here in Michigan, where the union movement has been such an integral part of our history. Can I get your thoughts on it? Really, this really is a moment in labor history.
If it is a moment, it's an unfortunate one, because Michigan had figured out how to be successful with its current system. Has been a high level of labor management cooperation in most employment settings, and there's a tremendous amount of work done on that, on finding innovative ways to resolve issues, resolve conflict in the workplace. Mm-hmm. And so in making this change, there's little doubt in my mind that, given that the labor movement is reasonably powerful in Michigan, that what we're going to see is higher levels of conflict in the workplace and in the political realm. If the Republicans, based on their 2010 electoral successes, push hard for this and other laws, then what's going to happen is clearly the unions and their political allies, largely the Democratic Party, are going to push back. And we'll probably see more constitutional referendums. We'll see more changes. And I don't think that's going to be particularly good for Michigan, because it will remove our focus from what really matters, which is economic growth and figuring out what the new Michigan economy looks like.
I'm talking with Dale Bellman, who's a professor in the School of Human Resources and Labor Relations at Michigan State University. Now, the Economic Alliance for Michigan is a labor management coalition, and they say right to work is what they call a treacherous path that our state should avoid. And you've got some heavy hitters like Ford Executive Chairman Bill Ford Jr. You have Chrysler CEO Sergio Marchionne in this group, alongside with the UAW's Bob King, which gets me wondering, what do you see are the pros and the pitfalls for Michigan businesses?
I think what you've seen is that there are a number of businesses that are organized that have developed very productive relationships with their workforces and the unions, and it's taken a long time. So that, for example, the new GM production system very much integrates employees and gives them a lot of control. At the Delta Township plant, they're not foremen. They're not supervisors. You essentially have work groups with facilitators who have a job to get done, and they do it largely under their own direction. Highly efficient. Some of the most efficient auto plants in the world are now in Michigan because of these changes. And so I don't think that Ford or GM or Chrysler have any interest in changing that relationship. But from their point of view, and this is long documented, problem then becomes that if you've got a right to work, some employees, either for the reason that they don't like unions or because it will save them money, will stop paying dues, and you'll start having internal conflict in the plants that will be disruptive to them. And so I think that there's a lot of concern about, we've got a system that works well, and has, in essence, is going in the right direction. Why do we want to take a chance and disrupt that? So I think that's what's driving those concerns.
What are your thoughts on what's happened today and with passage of right to work in Michigan? What does that do to the political force of labor unions? Do they still have clout?
I don't know. I mean, in the short term, clearly, the cloud of labor has been on the – well, it's been on the decline for years along with union membership. Is it going to decline – has it declined sufficiently that this goes through and labor unions just continue to decline? I'm dubious about this. If anything, I think that Governor Schneider was being kind of bright up until today, and I'm not sure why he did this great about face, to say we have bigger issues to deal with. Mm-hmm. We have to deal with the fact that Detroit is on the verge of becoming illiquid. We have an education system that we're trying to deal with and think our way through to make it work better. I think that what Governor Schneider has been facing is a Republican, in essence, supermajority, heavily Tea Party dominated, who are going to do whatever they care to do. Now, there's going to be a price tag on this. And the price tag is essentially what Schneider has done is he's confirmed that he's an enemy of labor, a political enemy of labor. And he was doing a pretty good job of not being that up until today. I work a fair bit in construction, and the building trades had a very ambiguous attitude towards Governor Schneider because he wants to build a bridge that's going to use a lot of building trades workers. Mm-hmm. He's done a lot of things that the unions weren't necessarily unhappy about. And I think that the net result is going to be now he's taking a position, which I don't think he wanted to take, and I suspect he was kind of frog marched into it. But at this point, he's got a whole series of issues sitting out there. And I said with Detroit, he has a whole – as a big issue which he could use cooperation on. And he's unlikely to get much cooperation on that anymore. On the whole education matter, probably could have used right to work as a form of leverage to make some what he sees as progress on education. At this point, that's very unlikely. And there's a good chance, I think, that you know this will become – we'll start looking like Wisconsin has looked. It's an ongoing struggle in the political realm. That's not good for Michigan at this point.
A sense of acrimony and bitterness.
Oh, acrimony, bitterness, but more important, people will be fighting every day and trying to figure out where the soft spots are. I've got to – I've had the – you know – what's going to – an example of this will be in Detroit where because of high level of conflicts between employees and the city of Detroit, and I'm most familiar with the police, essentially they're having an ongoing work slowdown in Detroit. Ticketing and arrests have dropped off by more than 50%, and there's just an ongoing war, and as a result, government performs very poorly in Detroit. And to the – it's just not a good thing. You try to find ways. We all have conflicts in our lives, and we typically find ways of dealing with them, of temporarily resolving the issue so we can work together. That's probably not going to be possible after today.
Dale Bellman, professor in the School of Human Resources and Labor Relations at Michigan State University. Thanks for talking with us today on Stateside.
My pleasure.
Let's take a moment now, move away from politics, and move to our weekly salute to a local hero, someone trying to make his or her corner of Michigan a better place. This week, we salute a 13-year-old young lady who discovered a very special way to share books. It happened while she was on vacation. Hannah Lane Davies is the founder of Kalamazoo's first little free library. Hi, Hannah. Welcome to Stateside.
Hello, Cindy. How are you?
Really, really good. Now, I had never heard of a little free library. Tell me what it is.
It is a box that's waterproof and wood, and it sits out in yards and parks and at schools, and it is filled with books. And these books are free. You don't have to pay to use them. We just request that you take a book and leave a book. And so it's a great way of promoting community and reading and literacy in whatever town you live in. It was started by Ted Bowl in Hudson, Wisconsin. And so I looked it up when I first saw one in St. Paul, and I just loved the idea, and I wanted to take one home to Kalamazoo.
Well, what does it look like? Describe the little free library that you built. What's it look like?
It looks kind of like a large birdhouse. That's how we usually explain it, but it's not really like a birdhouse. It's probably 2 feet by 2 feet, but it has a roof.
Okay, to protect the books.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, yeah. So it doesn't matter what the weather's like. Now, where did you get the books?
Well, we originally stocked the books, the library, with books that we had in our house, and we have a lot of books.
Mm-hmm.
So we had a lot of fun going through our bookshelves and picking out books that we thought other people would like. And then we had an opening, and we invited all of our neighbors, and 32 of our neighbors came, which was great. We had a great turnout. And they all brought books, and they would, you know, look through the library, and they picked out books that they liked and put their books in. So within the first week of having the Little Free Library in our front yard, we had completely new books.
Well, I know that the Little Free Library movement has registered yours as number 3,761, so you're part of a national movement. Do you want to build more?
Yes. My goal was 10 in Kalamazoo, and I have already chartered 10, and we have 3 in the ground, and which is totally awesome because it took us literally 2 months to have just 3 in Kalamazoo, and 10 people want them, so 7 more. There is a retirement community in Kalamazoo that has offered to build Little Free Libraries, which is great. And they are starting to build Little Free Libraries, and we try to get them to the people who want them.
That is so great. It strikes me you're going to have a really, really cool thing to write about for your college essay when you're applying for college.
Everybody keeps telling me.
Hannah, what's been the best part for you personally of bringing the whole idea of a Little Free Library to Kalamazoo?
I really love the enthusiasm from everyone that has encountered this and just the total sense of wonder of having something that is free and is happy in such kind of some difficult times for a lot of people.
Hannah Lane Davies is 13 years old. Still to come, Detroit is in the spotlight once again. We're going to talk with the directors of the film Burn, 1 year on the front lines in the battle to save Detroit, and one of the brave firefighters in the film. This is Stateside. We'll be right back. Stateside, I'm Cynthia Canty. It was November 2008 that a tragedy tore through the Detroit Fire Department. Firefighter Walter Harris was killed as he battled a blaze at an abandoned home in an arson fire. The headlines surrounding the death of the 17-year department veteran grabbed the attention of a pair of filmmakers, Tom Putnam and Brenna Sanchez. They began to ask themselves, what's it like to be a firefighter in Detroit, challenged by tens of thousands of abandoned buildings and arsonists and no money left to replace aging rigs and gear? The result of those questions is a documentary film called Burn, 1 year on the front lines in the battle to save Detroit, an audience award winner this year at the Tribeca Film Festival, by the way. The film is opening in the Detroit area tomorrow at the AMC 20 in Livonia and AMC Forum 30 in Sterling Heights, as well as in Chicago and Washington. The director-producers join us now. We want to welcome Brenna Sanchez and Tom Putnam. Good to have you on the show.
Thanks for having
us. Thank you so much.
And also joining us, one of the Detroit firefighters who helps make this film so remarkable and have such heart. He is retired now. Dave Parnell, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you so much for having me.
Good to have you. I want to start with you, Brenna, because you're from Detroit originally, and my understanding is you happened to be home when Walter Harris was killed. How did this launch you into the decision to make this film?
I actually was home during the holidays after the accident, and Tom Putnam called me and said, "Hey, did you hear this story?" And I hadn't heard it. And we both asked ourselves, why on earth would someone risk his life battling, you know, a fire in an abandoned structure, especially in a city full of abandoned structures? So I went down to Engine 5 and knocked on the door and asked a couple of the guys that question. And I came out, and Tom and I knew that there was a story here that about firefighters that hadn't been told in film or television before, a little more complex story than the heroes we've seen before.
And it really, you had to fight like firefighters knocking a fire down to get this film made and to get funding. Tom, talk to us a little about the response you initially got when you tried to shop your idea around.
Sure. We, you know, we've made documentaries before, and we went to, gosh, every broadcaster, every documentary funder, every network that you and the people listening to you watch, and they all said the same thing, which was, wow, this is amazingly compelling, it's an important story, it looks great, but no audience for a firefighter movie or a TV series.
And wow.
We didn't agree with that, and, you know, you're working with firefighters, those guys never say that they can't accomplish their mission or get the job done, so there was no way we were going to come back and say that we couldn't do that, so we took a pretty unique approach to it, and we just started going out to the people who had started following us on Facebook and liking our videos online, and we ended up raising our entire budget for the film through charitable donations, which for a movie, you know, of this size and scope is just unheard of.
You had amazing success on Kickstarter, and you had big support from General Motors, and then a real guardian angel whose name is Dennis Leary. Talk to us a little bit about his involvement, and especially why the whole issue of firefighters and safety is so personal to Dennis Leary.
Well, you know, Dennis, firefighters and their safety is very close to Dennis Leary's heart. He lost a cousin in a fire in Worcester, Massachusetts, where he's from. So he founded the Leary Firefighters Foundation. So he and the foundation and his partner, Jim Serpico, got behind the film because, you know, as a small film, you need to have a big name attached to it to get any kind of attention or press. So, you know, he came on, and we were able to get press and attention that we wouldn't ordinarily get. And it kind of gives us the stamp of approval because I think a lot of people just think of it. He was on Rescue Me for so long. People think of him as a firefighter more than an actor.
Yes,
so,
true.
Yeah, so within that community, it gave us a stamp of approval that has been very helpful.
We're talking with Tom Putnam and Brenna Sanchez, the documentary makers, the producer-directors of the new film, Burn, 1 year on the front lines in the battle to save Detroit. A year spent with Engine Company 50 on Detroit's east side, looking at what life is like for Detroit firefighters, including firefighter Dave Parnell, who's with us. Dave, when you discovered a film crew was going to show up at the firehouse, what was the reaction?
Ready to run.
I bet. Why was that?
Just the fear of what kind of repercussions we would have. Nobody warned us that they were coming. Nobody told us that they were going to come. And they walked in and said, "Hey, we're here to do a film. You're here to do what?" And we just kind of went in the kitchen and sat down and talked. We talked with the chief, who was a captain at that time, and the rest of the guys. And some of us said, "Well, if it's going to help the city, let's jump on board. If it's going to help us to get the things that we need as firefighters, let's get on board." And some said, "Well, I don't think I want to do that. They might get mad at us later on." And we said, "You know what? We risk everything when we go to a fire. Why not risk a little something and try and help these guys get the word out?" So that's how it began.
Well, I can tell you, Dave, my late father was a fire captain, and I can remember he was not especially welcoming when reporters and photographers and civilians would get in his way when there was a fire that needed to be knocked down. So I'm wondering, what did it take for Brenna and Tom to earn your trust of you and the other guys?
just asking the right kind of questions. Why do you do this? What inspires you to continue to do this with worn-out equipment, worn-out personal protection equipment? Just what the heck makes you guys tick? And as you continue to talk with them, you understood that they weren't trying to take sides for the city or for you. They were trying to show truly what firefighters do. And this is what firefighters do around the world. And as they continue to just say, hey, let us in so we can tell your story, we had to acknowledge that. And we said, yeah, we really need to let them in so that they can let the world know what's really going on.
Tom and Brenna, we're with Engine Company 50, and it's no stretch to call it one of the busiest firehouses in America, is it?
Not at all. Our first shoot there, we went there with a question about, you know, hey, are we going to get enough fires to tell a compelling story? And I think we went to 21 fires in two shifts with those guys. So if there's a busier firehouse, I feel bad for those guys.
I saw something in reading about Byrne that Los Angeles gets an average 11 structure fires a day with a population of 4 million, while in Detroit it's an average of 30 a day with a population of a little over 700,000. So there's a busy department. We have all seen movies about firefighters, Tom and Brenna. We've seen Backdraft, which I don't know if Dave will agree. I remember my late father and his buddies at Ferndale Fire Department not being real impressed with Backdraft. But this is not John Travolta or Joaquin Phoenix pretending to be firefighters. It's the real thing with the real firefighters. And I have to say, you took my breath away by the way you bring us right into those blazing buildings. Tell us a little more about how you shot the film. And you actually turned the firefighters into photographers, didn't you?
Yeah, we did. The guys, we used HD helmet cameras on them because we said, you know, if we're going to make a movie about firefighting, we want to go into the fire with these guys. We want people to see firefighting the way it really is and not be out, you know, on the sidewalk across the street and view it from afar. And I guess the guys were a little skeptical at the start, but pretty quickly, because they're firefighters, they're all these type A guys, they started asking to see dailies and critiquing each other's camera work and saying, oh, I should have held the shot longer, or what can I do better next time? So it ended up actually being a really good match. And I think through that process, the movie sort of went from being a movie we were making about these guys to being a movie we were making with them. Not just with the helmet cameras, but they often knew a whole other set of questions to ask that we would have never known, too. So it became a really fun, for us, collaborative process.
Dave Parnell, in the film, we really do come to know you and your family and your neighborhood, your homes in Detroit. And if I'm not mistaken, you're the only one at Engine 50 who lives where he works. These are your streets, and this is your neighborhood. And I got a real sense of kind of the sadness and regret that you feel as you stand on the street and look at the changes in your hometown. Can you tell us more about that?
It's sad when you literally watch your city just kind of crumbled around you. You're constantly asking for help from different agencies, you know, police, whatever it is. It doesn't matter what you need. But you're constantly asking the city council, listen, please quit arguing long enough to see what's going on my side of town. Please look at this and help me do something different. You know, the schools, everything. And then to just continue to see the houses. I mean, when I moved on my house, it was pristine. It was so beautiful. And then all of a sudden, there's vacant dwellings. There's houses that are starting to be burned. I mean, it's just unbelievable.
Yeah, yeah.
It hurts.
Yeah. It that comes across very, very clearly. And I get the sense, even though some of the other firefighters, they don't live in Detroit, I took note of your then-Captain Craig Doherty saying, you're doing this for the people who are left.
Well, they look at me and they say, you still live here. We're going to help you fight. And then they look at where they grew up, because most of those guys grew up in the same area. Most of them lived there. And there are other firefighters that still live in the city. And that's the important part that we have to understand. There's still firefighters that live there that want to see the city turned around. They want to see something better. And the guys that live outside the city say all the time, man, I wish that we could turn the city around so that I could move back in here. I could have a much larger home if I could just trust being safe here. And it comes down to that. Why do I have to live somewhere different to appreciate paying less in insurance? Why do I have to live somewhere different to be able to call the police and actually expect them to show up within a few minutes? Why do I have to live somewhere different in order to expect that? I expect that in my city, as does everyone who lives in whatever city it is that they live in. Why should it be any different?
It is something to follow, all of you, and it's done through the course of a year. We see you in action, and we also see you at the firehouse. And I'd like to get, Tom and Brenna, your thoughts as you kind of came in and kind of, you got that sense. I love the one comment somebody said, we're like cowboys in a big rodeo. I mean, these guys that you followed, really, they do love the job, despite the frustrations and the equipment problems, and that they love what they do.
Absolutely. I mean, it's pretty rare in life, I think, to be around a group of people from so many different backgrounds, so many walks of life, so many different interests, and they all come together in this job, and they view it the same way, and they have a common goal, and they all love what they do, and they give it 100% no matter what the odds are. I mean, I think as Chief Doherty said to us at one point, you know, if he had a horse in a bucket of water, he'd still get there and he'd put the fire out, and it's really true. And I think that sometimes people look at Detroit and they like to use it as an example of what's wrong with America, but then you spend time with these guys and you see they represent so many great things and such a strong work ethic and just desire to get the job done that is just, I mean, for me, it's incredibly inspiring.
And it wasn't just, you know, it wasn't just Engine 50. We filmed all over the city with several other fire companies that talked to so many different guys. And now, you know, we've toured with the film. We've been to 25 cities, so we've met firefighters from all over the country, and I've never met a more consistent group of human beings who are just all, you know, one goal, one team, and they're just in it together. And, you know, to get a glimpse of something like that, to be part of something like that, it makes you really push yourself harder and want to tell the straight story.
Dave, since the film was shot, you've retired. How's retirement treating you?
Oh, it's wonderful. It's different. You know, I still wake up, I still go by and see the guys. I still have it in my blood, but I like retirement.
Again, the film opens this weekend at the AMC 20 in Livonia and the Forum 30 in Sterling Heights. Much of the proceeds goes to the Leary Firefighters Foundation to help buy gear for Detroit firefighters. Now, we've posted the trailer to the film and links to the Byrne website. You can go to the stateside page at michiganradio.org. Tom Putnam, Brenna Sanchez, filmmakers, thank you for talking with us. And Dave Parnell, firefighter, Detroit, retired or not, you're a Detroit firefighter. And we've really appreciated talking with you today on Stateside.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And thank you again. We really appreciate you putting this out for us.
So let's end today's show on a, I don't know, lighter, festive note. People have enjoyed drinking beer in the great outdoors for a very, very long time. In fact, the roots of what is known as a beer garden date back to old school Germany. These days, beer gardens can be found in countries all over the world, including the U.S. and right here in Michigan. Recently, Stateside's Ellen Cortezoa went to a corner lot in a residential area in Detroit. It's probably not where you'd expect to find hundreds of people on a Sunday afternoon, but that is what happens when you combine beer, food, and people on a bright, sunny afternoon at Tajmu Beer Garden.
Knepper's next.
I don't know what's good.
Oh, everything's good. Jolly pumpkin.
We'll do some jolly pumpkin. Okay. It's a jolly pumpkin kind of day.
Dave Draper. I'm just a volunteer here at Tajmu today. So we've got maybe 300 people. It's 2 o'clock in the afternoon on Sunday. We've got kids out here with families, moms and dads, and people. A lot of bikers. A ton of bikers came through, and people just having a lot of fun.
My name is Suzanne Veer. I am the co-founder of Tajmu Beer Garden and the owner of Simply Suzanne Granola. Both companies are based in Detroit.
I'm Aaron Wagner. I am co-founders of Tajmu Beer Garden. Well, we have a completely packed beer garden. Pretty much every table is filled. They're playing every cornhole game. There's a small line for beer, but it's not bad.
So you want $6, you get 3 tickets.
We have, let's see, 6 beers pouring right now. All of them are Michigan beers. We have food vendors down here as well. Porktown sausage, People's Pierogi, Corridor sausage, Treat Dreams ice cream. So, you know, it's really a nice flow.
Well, we actually were up north, and we were drinking a beer in the spring this time, well, last year. And we were talking about how amazing it would be to have something like that in Detroit. And we were living in West Village, and it's very much of a community neighborhood, really amazing housing stock, historic homes. And we made the decision to have the beer garden here. He always wanted to start a bar, and I had done a lot of travel in Eastern Europe, and beer gardens were one of my favorite places to kind of go and really learn about the community. So we created Taj Mu.
I mean, we were anticipating 200 to 300 people would come through in the first day, and we ended up with like almost 1,200. So, yeah, it was a lot more than we expected.
Taj Mu means meeting place, actually in the Native American language, but we actually didn't know that.
It matters because this community, like a lot of Detroit, needs people to get together and be looking out for each other and be rebuilding the homes, raising the profile, and making it safer and a better place to be.
Hi, good to see you. Good to see you. Thank you.
And just before winter really kicks in, Taj Mu will have one last event. It's this Sunday, and you can get all the details by going to our website at michiganradio.org. Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Stateside is engineered by Bob Scon. Contributors are Allie Billings, Ellen Cortezoa, Emily Fox, Cameron Stewart, and Mercedes Mejia. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you for listening, and let's talk again at 3 on Monday.